listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and information from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Okay, let's just dive right in. We got a whole lot of stuff to cover this week.
Yeah, and on the big event, obviously, over the next week is going to be the Venezuelan election on May 20th.
For sure.
And shortly after that, 1 week later, there's the presidential election in Colombia. Obviously, things in Argentina are not going as well as the government there might like. They've had to go begging to the IMF for assistance, and although they're asking for something, I think they're asking for $25 billion in assistance for the Argentinian economy. They're probably going to need at least double that. And so, and what we were talking about, what you and I were been talking about right from the start, ever since Macri won the election back in November 2015, was how long it would take for his policies to come unstuck, and for the Argentinian people to realize that they made a horrendous mistake. And one has to remember, of course, that in that election, Macri only won by, I think it was barely 2%. A very, very tight vote. So it's hardly surprising that huge sectors of the Argentinian population are now very much up in arms and demonstrating against various of the measures that Mauricio Macri has taken.
Yeah, I mean, he got elected partly because the left, or portions of the left, sat on their hands.
Yeah, sure.
And
that that has been a huge mistake in various countries in Latin America over the last few years on the part of left-wing and progressive political movements. In Chile, for example, and the Sebastian Piñera won again because the left went into left and progressive forces went into the election divided. And there we're also likely to see the economic policies that Sebastian Piñera is likely to promote will further polarize society in Chile, and within a couple of years we're likely to see extreme social conflict there, just as we're seeing now in Argentina. So it's interesting to see how in elsewhere, take Mexico as an example. And in Mexico, the presidential elections and other elections, municipal elections as well, and I think possibly also the legislature are scheduled for, I think, July. And there, over 100 candidates have been assassinated in the different elections that are scheduled for July. But you never read about that in the international corporate media. What you read about are events here in Nicaragua, events in Venezuela. The economy in Venezuela is always a target for ill-informed comment from the international and corporate media.
Yeah.
And also in Colombia, and you've got a situation where almost every day, barely a day goes by without the murder of some social activist or a former FARC member of the FARC guerrilla movement that made a very difficult decision to go into a peace process with the Colombian government. And now, as become all too apparent, the fears and suspicions of people who doubted the integrity of the Colombian government's commitment to the peace process and Colombian institutions in general, the courts, the legislature, and so forth. I mean, we were all right because we were all correct to doubt that the Colombian peace process would be implemented as it was signed. And now we're in a situation where I think since January, well over 40, perhaps over 50 social activists across the country, indigenous peoples activists, community leaders of one kind or another, as well as former members of the FARC, guerrilla, have been murdered. And you've also had in the electoral process in Colombia, there have been death threats against Gustavo Petro, for example, who's the progressive candidate with a real chance of getting into the second round, because in Colombia they have a two-round process whereby the two leading candidates from the first round, if there's no over 50% majority in that first round for the winning candidate, the two leading candidates go into a second round runoff, and Gustavo Petro is likely to make it to that runoff, and it's by no means clear how things will pan out. The most likely event is that the right wing candidate Iván Duque will win, who's associated with the extreme right wing led by former President Álvaro Uribe. So if Duque wins, you can kiss goodbye to the peace process. And it's very, very difficult to see how the peace process as signed by Juan Manuel Santos, well, getting on for a year and a half ago now, will survive a presidency of somebody like Iván Duque, who's associated with Álvaro Uribe, whose legislative bloc have done everything they can, and his allies in the judiciary, to sabotage the peace process.
Well,
so then, going back to Mexico, and it's very clear that Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the progressive candidate there, is streets ahead of any of the other candidates in the presidential election.
Just so people know, by the way, also, this is a really important election there. It's July 1st. It's the presidential election. It's the national legislative elections, you know, senators and all of that. And it's also the local election in 30 of the 32 states. It's the largest single election in the history of Mexico, it's being called.
Right. Right. And Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he's on something like 40%. And the nearest opposition, sorry, the nearest kind of
competitor,
right wing political candidate is around 27-28%.
Right.
So, if you go to Brazil, look at Brazil, and Lula da Silva remains in jail on completely baseless charges of corruption, that the prosecution offered zero evidence, that apart from circumstantial evidence, and even that doesn't stand up to any reasonable independent scrutiny. He is also leading the voting intentions. Were he allowed to run, he would win. And so all this stuff about the conservative restoration and all that is complete nonsense in terms of the popular electorate. And you can let's go back to Argentina. And Macri is now, his levels of support have dropped below 30%. So if an election were held tomorrow between a relatively progressive presidential candidate and a candidate, I think Macri would be allowed to stand for re-election under Argentina's constitution. And the progressive candidate or the social democrat candidate, somebody of that stripe, would easily win against Macri.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in Venezuela, despite everything, despite all that the United States has done to sabotage the Venezuelan economy, to make threats of military intervention, to mobilize countries like Colombia and Brazil and Chile, Peru, all these countries led by right-wing governments to try and diplomatically isolate Venezuela, all that has completely failed. And it looks as though, if one can take the most recent opinion polls seriously, Maduro is on something like 50% of, or something over 50%,
right,
in terms of the likely electoral outcome, whereas Henry Falcón, the principal right wing candidate. And he's down on around, I think, 30%.
Right.
And the other candidate, a guy called Bertucci, Javier Bertucci, he's a kind of evangelical, his base is the evangelical churches in Venezuela. I think he's on around 16%, 17%, something like that. Now, there again, you have a situation where if the right wing were to unite and put forward a single candidate, which they can't do now, it's too late, but they were talking about it and they failed to agree, and the opposition might stand a chance of running Nicolas Maduro's candidacy close. But as things stand, it's very clear that Nicolas Maduro is overwhelmingly likely to win that election in Venezuela, despite everything that the United States and its local allies and countries like Spain in the European Union and the European Union itself to some extent have done to try and isolate Venezuela. They've completely failed in terms of domestic political support,
right, which is what counts when you're going into an election. They've pulled all the stops out up here. I was amazed flipping through the channels on cable yesterday. This John Oliver, alleged comedian that has a regular show on HBO, Last Week Tonight, it's called, goes into I'm flipping channels and there's this, I don't know, 10, 12 minute long piece. And it's, here are the statements in it. Nicolas Maduro is a brutal dictator who is starving the Venezuelan people, and when they complain, he shoots them. That's basically the story.
And maybe we should switch. We should switch to Venezuela, from Venezuela to Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Because here in Nicaragua, and I think it's you're getting the same kind of story. I mean, if you read the international media, if you read the right-wing media here, there were peaceful protests that were attacked by the police on April the 18th, which is completely untrue. And ever since then, the government has been shooting peaceful protesters, and it's all the government's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the storyline that you get if you read the international media and if you read the right-wing media here. And that is the dominant message, of course, across the social media.
Mm.
But what in fact happened was that rival students clashed on April the 18th. The police tried to keep order. And then immediately from Thursday, April the 19th onwards, right-wing shock groups were using lethal force to attack the police, and they would use the student protests as camouflage. And between Thursday, April 19th, and Monday, April 23rd, and there were something like 20 to 23 deaths in very confused circumstances. Nobody can legitimately say how many protesters were killed, if any peaceful protesters were killed. And what we can say with certainty is that two police were killed, a Sandinista journalist was killed, three or four Sandinista activists were killed, and various innocent bystanders out of those 20 to 23. Mm. So then from April 23rd onwards, and then on April 21st, Saturday, April 21st, Sunday, April 22nd, the government withdrew the Social Security forms that were the alleged pretext for these protests. But for any independent observer watching that, looking at that, it was obvious that this was a very well planned soft coup stroke regime change operation. And that has continued, because from that weekend, the police very, very pointedly withdrew from doing anything beyond minimum control of public order, especially in Managua. And from that time on, despite constant calls for a peaceful resolution of the conflict, despite an agreement by the main parties concerned, the government, the private business sector organization, the Catholic Church and its right-wing hierarchy, evangelical pastors across the country, all those elements, and even the student leaders agreed that they would set up a national dialogue, and that was the way to try and resolve the crisis provoked by the initial protests by the students and the subsequent hijacking of those protests by extreme right wingers. Yeah. Now, from that time on, from April 23rd on, the right wing have consistently maintained their attacks against public institutions. They burnt down municipal offices. They've attacked ordinary motorists. I mean, they and public transport. They're rival groups of right wing taxi drivers and taxi drivers that want dialogue that have clashed in Managua, and there've been attacks on even passengers in taxis. And all that violence comes from the right wing, and they stooped so low at one point that they attacked a bus carrying children with disability from their special school back to their homes.
Oh my God!
And it was it's all very, very similar to events in Venezuela. Do you remember in Caracas during the protests back last year, and I think it was in June of last year.
And they were stringing wire across the road so that people on motorcycles would
They attacked a preschool.
Yeah, that's right, too.
And it was... So, and the right-wing violence, which gets zero coverage in the international media for right. practical purposes, goes completely under the radar. But the people, the subsequently people that have been killed in those protests have almost without exception been either bystanders or people just out of curiosity trying to see what's going on, or government activists and Sandinista activists trying to defend the government. And over the weekend, these right-wing gangs burned down the craft market, an internationally famous craft market in a tourist center, a very popular tourist center, Masaya. A Sandinista activist was shot dead during that attack. It's just like what happened in Libya, what happened in Syria, what happened in Venezuela, all these attacks against governments that do have a popular majority. And there's no doubt at all that here in Nicaragua, an overwhelming majority of people support the government and the policies that they've implemented over the last 10 years. But what you get in the international media is this downright lie, and they pick it up from local media. Local media put, I was reading in El Nuevo Diario, which is the business sector newspaper here, a completely false set of assertions about what was the timeline since April the 18th, and putting all the blame on the government and zero blame on the violent right-wing opposition gangs that have been responsible for over 90% of the violence.
Have they continued to, Nicaragua, have the private media there continued to cover the stolen election next door in Honduras, the protests, the wide protests by the opposition?
No, forget it.
And the murder of activists there, too, by the government and by the right-wing squads.
Yeah, and the fact that, and how many journalists is it now that have been killed since 2016 in Honduras?
Right.
Is it something like 40?
A lot.
And all the people that have been murdered by the police and the army in Honduras. They're not going to report that. No, and so they build up this completely false picture of events here in Nicaragua. But the reality for them is it's completely relentless that most people in Nicaragua support the government, support President Daniel Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo, and the opposition are now desperate to try and maintain the impetus and the momentum of the protests that they hijacked back on in mid-April. But the only way they're able to do that is by alienating people even more, by using the tactic of roadblocks to damage the economy and bring normal life to a halt if they can. And you can do that in Nicaragua. Nicaragua's roads and the main highways are very easy to block. A few hundred people can shut down traffic in Nicaragua very, very effectively because, and for example, just about 45 kilometers, 50 kilometers south of where I am in Esteli, and there's a fork in the road that goes, one fork goes out to the northern Atlantic coast and the other comes up here to Esteli and then on to the frontier with Honduras and Samoto and Ocotal. And if you block that fork, then traffic in both directions it's completely completely stopped.
Right.
So, and you don't need many people to do that, especially if the police are deliberately avoiding confrontation.
Right.
And so, and the government strategy seems to be to insist on dialogue, insist on peace, and not provoke confrontation, and let ordinary Nicaraguans see that it's the right wing that are trying to destroy Nicaragua's economy. And that's absolutely clear. There's been a chorus of protests from producers and business people around the country condemning the right-wing roadblocks. So let's see what happens over the next few days.
Right.
But the it's very unlikely that the right wing will be able to maintain support for what they're trying to do, despite what their local media try to project in terms of lying about, oh, it's all the government's fault. When in fact, ever since certainly April 22nd, and it's been the right-wing opposition that have been very, very clearly responsible for the overwhelming number of violent incidents that have taken place in Nicaragua since then. So then, and to try and put that in the regional context, and the army here has publicly stated that they are not going to take action against the protesters because that's not their constitutional role. And but they support government and they support the peace process and they want the various political actors involved to get into negotiations. Now, if you compare that with anywhere else, and El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, in Costa Rica pretends it doesn't have an army, but it has paramilitary forces that are hardly distinguishable from an army. And if the level of violence and the level of economic and social disruption that has taken place in Nicaragua had happened there, you'd have a death toll running into hundreds, you know, because the army would shoot people in those countries. And we've seen that. I mean, that's not kind of speculation. We know that's what they do, even against peaceful protests. Genuinely, here in Nicaragua, there have been peaceful protests that have by the opposition and by government supporters that have gone off perfectly calmly, with no repression from the police. And ever since that weekend of 21st and 22nd, the police have taken the position that they are only going to do a minimum to maintain public order, so as to avoid confrontation.
Right.
And so, but if those peaceful protests had happened in Honduras, we've seen what the police and the army do in Honduras.
Well, yeah.
And if they, against peaceful protesters, so if you then had armed groups murdering police, seriously wounding police, and another incident that happened last week was that right-wing gangs shot and seriously wounded four police who were just on traffic duty. If that happened in Honduras or in El Salvador or in Guatemala, and there'd be wholesale massacres of the right-wing gangs, although they wouldn't be right-wing gangs, they'd be
right.
And that's the difference between in a regional context, the difference between left-wing grassroots activists is that they'll try the electoral route, they'll try the peaceful route, to try and get the political changes that they want. But why? And if you ask, well, why is there so much political violence from the right wing in Nicaragua? It's because they have completely failed to get political power via elections. Election after election, their support is around 30% in total, and they always go into elections divided, and the support for the government has always been over 60% in recent elections.
Yep.
So, and that is why there's all this violence from the right wing in Nicaragua. And there are two fundamental contradictions Don, I don't know if you've got time.
You've got about 30 seconds, so go ahead.
Yeah, and the fundamental contradiction is, are you really going to believe that people like Marco Rubio and Ileana Ros-Lehtinen and their local sympathizers are trying to promote democracy in Nicaragua? And it's just ridiculous.
Or peace, for that matter, or social or economic justice, for that matter, when all you need to do is drive around their own districts and the question answers itself. We'll be back with you again later this week and taking a look at the coming election in Venezuela next Sunday and trying to lay things out for people as we go into that. And thank you very much, Tony, for your kind information.
You're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you next time.
Same. Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. The Iranian nuclear deal, once branded as a major achievement of American diplomacy, has now become the poster child for the absence of it. Donald Trump's decision to renege on the agreement not only reopens a major international problem, but it also calls into question the very means of solving it. With allies betrayed and adversaries befuddled, how should the world navigate its way forward? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jared Blank, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and formerly U.S. State Department coordinator for Iran nuclear implementation. Mr. Blank, it's so good to talk to you. Thank you very much for finding time for us.
Thank you.
Now, I'm sure you are greatly disappointed by President Trump's decision to walk away from the JCPOA, but hopefully there is still some room for damage control. How much of it do you believe can still be salvaged?
Well, I suppose you can call it damage control. There, from a U.S. perspective, no good outcomes here. One possibility is that the path that we're currently on is successful, and that's that immediately after President Trump's announcement, President Rouhani said, okay, we're going to stay in the deal for a little while and give time for the other participants, mainly the three European countries, to see what they can offer us to make it worth our while to stay in long term. That could succeed. It would be good from the perspective that it would keep Iran's nuclear program under control and under inspection, but it would leave the United States very isolated and Europe poorly positioned to confront other problematic Iranian policies. Alternatively, those negotiations might fail, which would lead to a resumption of industrial scale enrichment and a serious, serious problem for the region and the world.
Now, Trump is obviously in violation of the American obligations, but to some extent, he's true to his word, because last winter, he gave the Europeans what looked like an ultimatum that he was going to do it unless the transatlantic allies could agree on some ways of shoring up the deal. And I gather from your articles that the talks, which began in January, were progressing fairly well. What do you think may have happened to upset all that progress?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lack of sincerity on President Trump's part. He wasn't really looking to come to an agreement with our allies. He was looking to act on his animus toward his predecessor, Barack Obama. And also the total chaos and dysfunction in this administration. So the president gave his ultimatum. Senior officials worked on negotiations with the Europeans. I don't think that there was any process to brief the president on that progress. And so, you know, he heard about it from President Macron and from Chancellor Merkel, but had not been buying into the decisions made along the way.
As you pointed out in one of your articles, there were a number of things that Trump could have done. He could have extended the sanctions waiver to allow a little bit more time for the talks, and yet he decided to end it abruptly. After all those meetings, cordial meetings with President Macron and Chancellor Merkel, to the Russians, that looked kind of rude. Do you think he was trying to make some point, to send some message to the Europeans, or is it just Mr. Trump being who he is?
You know, it's hard to know if he was trying to send a message, but certainly after all the bonhomie of the Macron meeting, after the supposedly improved atmosphere in the Merkel meeting, and then he actually tweeted his intention to make this announcement and sort of telegraphed where it was going while Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson was actually in Washington trying to convince Vice President Pence and the Secretary of State to continue the negotiations. Whether or not he was intending to be rude, whether he was trying to send a message, this clearly isn't the way allies behave toward one another.
The Russians are often accused of entertaining all sorts of conspiracy theories, and I personally think that's a cultural thing rather than political, because we enjoy counterintuitive explanations. And one such conspiracy theory that's been stalking me as I was preparing for this program is a thought of whether or not Iran is the main thing here. Do you really think that the major thing here, as Mr. Trump says, is the fear of Iran's potential nuclear program?
Oh, absolutely not. If the concern were Iran's nuclear program, the solution was the JCPOA. If anything, the pulling out of the JCPOA, running the risk that Iran will restart industrial-scale enrichment, that raises the possibility of increased conflict across the board. So if you want a conflict with Iran, this is the way to go. This is obviously not about trying to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions. But I'll say that what I think this is really about is Barack Obama. President Trump is trying to tear down the accomplishments of his predecessor. I think it's pretty clear from his public remarks that he does not understand what was in the JCPOA or what is in the JCPOA, and it doesn't really matter to him. He doesn't have a policy objective. He just wants to disparage Barack Obama.
And what about the so-called European allies? Because there are so many issues involved. I mean, the fate of the European exemptions from tariffs on steel and aluminum is still very much up in the air. Mr. Trump is supposed to make his decision until June 1st. Now there is a threat of secondary sanctions. We are talking about a very, very large chunk of the economy. Do you think all these economic issues, and I'm trying to phrase it very carefully, not to be accused of Russian bias, but still, do you think these economic issues are going to be featured in the political discussions on Iran?
Sure. I mean, the first thing I need to say about this is that from Europe's perspective, Iran does not matter economically. So whatever decisions Europe makes vis-a-vis the JCPOA are going to be national security decisions and political decisions. If they want Iran to stay in the JCPOA, they're going to have to offer some additional economic benefits. But that's not because Europe is, you know, deeply enamored of the possibility of trade with Iran. I do think, though, to your question, to your broader question, Europe is perceiving all of these things as a piece. So the steel and aluminum tariffs, the recent sanctions on Russia, the resumption of sanctions on Iran. I think you see the United States disregarding the needs and interests of its allies. And Europe and other allies are going to have to look at this and decide how to respond in order to protect their own concerns.
Well, and yet, Mr. Blank, you suggested before that in the event of Trump's pullout, Europe will likely side with the United States, even if it blames the current administration for ruining this deal. And if it does, I think the European leaders will essentially have to accept that their level of credibility is the same as Trump's, that they are moral equals. And I personally don't think there's much trouble on that side as far as the UK is concerned. But when it comes to Germany, when it comes to France, do you think they can afford it from a moral point of view? Do you think Chancellor Merkel, for one, can bring herself to be seen as standing shoulder to shoulder with Trump on that?
Well, first of all, I think that's a little bit unfair. Trump is the actor. He's the decision maker in this terrible decision. The European leaders are now stuck with a series of very uncomfortable dilemmas that they will need to resolve. But they're not the ones who created this disaster. What I wrote, though, was that if Iran were to respond to our violation with a violation of their own, I'm quite sure that Europe will side with the United States. If you have the U.S. out of compliance and Iran out of compliance, then Europe will side with us, even if it's our fault. if Iran manages to stay in compliance, I think Europe is in a much more difficult situation, and the possibility that they will try to strike an additional bargain with Iran to provide some replacement economic benefits is real.
But I think the question here is not only striking additional concessions for Iran, but also negotiating that with the United States, because I'm pretty sure you heard a number of officials in the Trump administration directly almost ordering European companies, German companies, to get out of Iran, to cease their business operations there immediately. And that hardly seems to be the language that you employ with the allies. But putting that aside, do you think the United States needs to be taught a lesson here? That's essentially the question I'm trying to ask you. Do you think the European Union needs to take a moral stance on this particular issue to show the United States, the Trump administration in this example, that this is not okay to conduct international policies like that?
I'm an American and I'm an American former official. I'm not going to call on Europe or anyone else to teach the United States a lesson. I think Europe has got a very, very hard set of decisions to make, where they'll need to weigh problems in the transatlantic relationship against their real concerns, their national security concerns, about the resumption of an Iranian unconstrained nuclear program. And I'm sympathetic to how difficult those decisions are going to be. As I started out by saying, from the US perspective, there are only bad answers here. Either you've got Europe essentially isolating us because they find a way to save the deal, or you've got Europe failing to save the deal and Iran returning to unconstrained enrichment, which is a huge problem for us, for Europe, and for the world.
But hold on, Mr. Blank. You may have forgotten, but it was the administration you worked for, the Obama administration, which was very proud of forging the so-called European consensus on sanctions against Russia back in 2014. And the rationale back then was that Russia, in your eyes, violated certain norms of behavior and needed to be sent a signal that this is not the way you conduct yourself on the international arena. Now, we now have the United States, which clearly violated its obligations, which is involved in behavior that you clearly disapprove of. You made it very clear throughout this program, which also leads to an increase in confrontation in the Middle East. Shouldn't the United States be sent a similar signal that this is not the kind of behavior that its European allies welcome on the international arena?
Leaders around the world, including from our closest allies, have condemned this decision. The very fact that Europe has now shifted from negotiating with the United States to negotiating with Iran is a strong rebuke to the decision that President Trump made. I'd describe President Obama's leadership on sanctions with Iran, with Russia, with other countries a little bit differently from what you did, though. I don't think it's a question about Germany making a moral stand or a value judgment. What I would say is that we were able to convince countries around the world that on a variety of problems, we had a plan and a way forward, and that if countries were willing to suffer a certain amount of economic dislocation in the short term, we could solve real problems. And so in the Iran case, we were able to convince the government of Russia, of China, of India, as well as our closest allies, to stick with us, and we got to the JCPOA. On some of Russia's policies, we were able to convince, as you say, Germany and other European countries to suffer some real economic harm because they thought we had a plan. I think the problem now is that the United States is proving that we cannot be trusted with this tool, and so the chances of getting even our closest allies, let alone non-traditional partners like Russia, like China, to side with us, I think they're much, much reduced.
I don't know if you heard this, but Chancellor Merkel said the other day that Europe can no longer rely on the United States in order to protect itself. And I would argue that the more pressing question right now is whether Europe can really take it for granted that the United States will not lash out at Europe economically. Do you think the threat of secondary sanctions is real? Do you think the United States could come with full force against European countries if they decide to continue trading with Iran, provided, of course, if Iran is in compliance with the JCPOA?
So the threat of secondary sanctions is very real. Basically, this idea that, If you're a non-U.S. company, you've got to choose. Do you want to do business with Iran or do you want to do business with the United States? And for most companies, that's going to be an easy choice. And for most companies, the threat is sufficient. The U.S. doesn't really have to do much enforcement in order to get a lot of big companies to say, you know what, this isn't worth the risk. But European governments do have tools available to them to seek to counter the secondary sanctions threat. And that's the question I think that's going to be on the table when Europe negotiates with Iran, with Russia, with China, with the remaining participants in the JCPOA, to see if there's a way to salvage a sort of a rump version of the JCPOA. And if Europe were to try to deploy those tools, then you could be in a situation of some confrontation, government-to-government confrontation between the U.S. and our allies. But we're still a little ways off from that at this point.
Well, Mr. Blank, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jared Blank, former U.S. State Department Coordinator for Iran Nuclear Implementation. Mr. Blank, just before the break, we talked about the European reaction to Trump's decision. And let me ask you a few questions about Russia. As you may imagine, many people in Moscow are very, very skeptical of all these speculations about Trump's supposed collusion with the Kremlin. But given where we are with the Iranian nuclear issue, Trump's rebuke of both the American obligations and your European allies, don't you wish Moscow had some leverage, some rapport with this administration?
Well, you know, on the collusion question, I'll just say we don't know whether or not laws, what specific laws might have been violated in the United States. We don't know what President Trump himself knew. What is out in the public, though, obviously demonstrates that the Trump campaign colluded with Russian actors in a way that is deeply disturbing for American
democracy. I don't want to make this discussion about the Russian collusion, but what is out in the public at this point of time is the indictment of 13 Russian nationals who tried to do something on social media, who have horrible English, whose posts have been viewed by, in some cases, zero people. So I think you guys are blowing it out of proportion. But anyway, let's stick to the to Iran.
And the Trump Tower meeting and the payments to Michael Cohen's accounts. I mean, the question is not whether or not the efforts were successful. I think the point is that the public documentation shows that the Trump campaign tried. But as to your question, do I wish that Russia had leverage over Trump, President Trump? I guess what I would say is this. I remember a time not so long ago when I was working on Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran in the Obama administration that we were able to compartmentalize our agreements and disagreements with Russia. So there were some areas where we had, you know, very serious disagreements and we confronted each other on those disagreements. We were, as I said, occasional adversaries. But where our national security interests overlapped, for example, in Afghanistan, for example, on Iran's nuclear program, we retained the ability to work together and to achieve things. And I do very much regret that the politics, I think, in both of our countries is pushing us away from the ability to be at least occasional partners. I think that's not good for us. It's not good for you. It's not good for the world.
For the time being, Moscow has been very restrained in its reaction to Trump's announcement about the JCPOA. But short-term, Russia is set to benefit from the increase in oil prices, even though it said both before and now that it values strategic stability more than short-term material gain. Now, from my point of view, the Kremlin will now have to think very carefully whether it wants to be proactive in its defense of the JCPOA or whether it just wants to go with the flow and let the Europeans have the initiative. What would you personally like to see?
Well, I think you're right that both Russia and China, we've spoken a lot about the E3 European countries, but both Russia and China also have some decisions to make here. As you say, how active do you want to be in the defense of the JCPOA? And how much potentially do you see the resumption of U.S. secondary sanctions as creating commercial opportunities for your firms in Iran? What I would hope, at least in the immediate term, is that Iran is clearly trying to make an effort to see if it's possible to salvage the deal. Foreign Minister Zarif is visiting Moscow, he's visiting Beijing, he's visiting Brussels. It's hard to know what those negotiations, what those conversations will look like and whether in the end I would think that whatever emerges from them is a good idea. But I do hope that all of the remaining participants in the JCPOA will make a sincere effort to figure out if the deal can be salvaged.
Now, you've given a number of interviews lately in which you essentially explain how unfair is Trump's criticism of President Obama's dedication to the JCPOA. But I wonder if there was anything that the Obama administration could have done to make it more difficult for its successor to renege on the agreement.
You know, when I was asked in 2016, what happens if Donald Trump wins the presidency, will he tear up the deal? My answer was always, it is hard to imagine any president of the United States tearing up this deal if it's working, if it's managing to constrain Iran from developing a nuclear program and imposing all of these very strict inspections on Iran. I said it and I believed it. And as problematic as the Trump administration has been so far, I still find myself surprised at every new bad decision they manage to make. Now, in terms of the question of, you know, would it have been possible to make it more legally difficult for Trump to pull out? The answer is really no. There's been a lot of talk in Washington, maybe you're referring to the idea that if this had been a treaty through the Senate, Trump could not have pulled out. That's not really legally the case. Previous presidents, Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush, have pulled out of treaties just on executive authority. So even if you could imagine that the Republicans would have seriously considered an Obama-proposed deal back in 2015, 2016, it would not have protected that deal from Trump.
You also made a point in one of your articles that when the JCPOA was drafted, it was primarily built to respond to possible Iranian violations. Nobody could have foreseen that they need to guard against American non-compliance. And I wonder what is the implication of that? Because you mentioned that there were a number of previous American presidents who essentially walked away from the previous deals. But it seems to me that the message to the rest of the world here is that you can strike deals with the United States, but they will only last as long as the current administration is in office.
Well, unfortunately, I think that that's right. I think that there is President Trump's decision is dangerous for in the Iran situation. It's dangerous for the region, but it also does undermine the position of the United States in the world. We are demonstrating that we cannot take yes for an answer, and that makes it very, very difficult to make credible deals with the United States, with any future president of the United States. So hopefully we'll be able to recover, that we'll be able to demonstrate that our political system has come to its senses, but it's going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned before that on a number of strategic and important issues, the Obama administration and the Putin administration, despite the lack of very warm personal chemistry between the two leaders, they were able to find some degree of compromise. They could work together. But obviously, I think in Moscow, at least, there is a sense of missed opportunities. What's interesting about Donald Trump is that so far he has been finding it very hard to find this strategic overlap with his adversaries, but he found one geopolitical soulmate, and this is Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you think the two are working in concert, or do you think that policies are planned, mutually planned and coordinated, or is Israel just being opportunistic in following or perhaps orchestrating, directing President Trump's lead?
So, you know, I think it's very difficult to work in concert with the Trump administration because the Trump administration is so internally chaotic. They don't have anything that resembles a normal policy process in the United States. And so I'm a little bit skeptical that anybody, including Prime Minister Netanyahu, is really working in concert. I think that this is more opportunistic. You see where President Trump's sort of biases and gut feelings take him, and then you see what you can do with that. And so, you know, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu wants a more confrontational U.S. position toward Iran. He wasn't going to get that in Syria because President Trump doesn't want a deeper investment in Syria. So he found a place where he might be able to rile up the Trump administration and increase the risk of confrontation.
Now, as you perhaps know, Prime Minister Netanyahu has just visited Moscow, and sources here say that he's trying to advance a very interesting narrative. He's suggesting that after Trump's pullout from the JCPOA, the threat emanating from Iran is ever more pressing, despite the fact that it was in fact Israel which has been clamoring for the American administration to abandon this deal. Do you think Israel is poised to become even more proactive in quote-unquote defending its security in other countries, and where can it lead all of us?
Well, you know, for a long time, I've been trying to remind people to distinguish between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu has spoken, you know, bitterly and angrily about the JCPOA. The Israeli security establishment, including now a string of chiefs of army staff, have all made clear that the JCPOA worked for Israel by removing the existential threat that an Iranian nuclear program would have been, and just making Iran a threat, but not an existential one. So to some extent, I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is now, in a phrase we use in English, the dog who caught the car. He got what his rhetoric wanted, but he's right that this does pose real risks for Israel. The right response would be to try to find ways to de-escalate the situation with Iran on Syria and other issues. I think, as we've seen this week, there's certainly a risk that Netanyahu will take the other course and see this as an opportunity to escalate tension and see if he can draw the United States into a regional conflict that, you know, to be honest, President Trump's instincts in this case are right. He'd like to avoid.
Now, the Iranians, and you also wrote it in one of your articles, now have a lot of things to consider. The economic pressure, the I would suggest very provocative Israeli behavior, certainly emboldened by Trump's moves. Also, the considerations of domestic politics come into play here. This multiplicity of challenges, do you think it's likely to make Iran more careful, more cautious, or on the contrary, make it feel that it has nothing else to lose?
You know, before I answer that question, I do want to say, you know, I heard you refer to Israeli steps as provocative. I would just say that everybody acting across that Israel-Syria border is being provocative right now. The Iranians are being provocative, the Israelis as well. It's incumbent on everybody to try to lower the temperature.
Mr. Blank, let me get to this point, because I don't think there is moral equivalence here, because Iranians and the Russians, as much as you may hate their presence in Syria, are there on the invitation of the legitimate UN-recognized government. You may question the legitimacy of Assad, as the United States has done informally, but you have never sought to revoke its membership in the United Nations. So your government also recognizes the legitimacy of the Syrian state, at least at this point of time. So suggesting that Iranians flying over the Syrian territory, throwing bombs on the Syrian cities, Syrian facilities, is not provocative. I think this is not a fair comparison.
So I didn't say it wasn't provocative. I said that everybody was being provocative. You keep bringing us back to these legal and moral questions. I would just say I'm focused on, I think, an overarching moral question, which is how do you avoid a war? And the fact is that Israel does have real national security concerns about what's going on in Syria, including the Iranian presence. And it's in everybody's deeper interest, I believe, to try to lower the temperature. Now, to go back to your earlier question, which is, you know, what does this mean in Iran? Is Iran going to be pushed into a corner? Do they act more provocatively, or are they on the defensive? You know, my guess is that we talked a little earlier about compartmentalization. I think you're going to see some of that out of Iran as well. I think there are going to be areas where they try to be conciliatory toward Europe and others, and there are probably going to be areas where they feel like they can or they need to be fairly provocative. And again, my hope is that everybody will take a step back from that and try to find ways to prevent an escalation which would be dangerous for all of us.
Well, Mr. Blank, I can certainly agree to that. We have to leave it there. I really appreciate you sharing your perspective with us today. And our viewers can keep this conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again. Same place, same time here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.